So welcome back. The fun continues. So how many of you have ever moved money from one currency to another? Okay. How many of you only use banks to do that? Okay. How many of you use TransferWise? I think he's happy. I'm thrilled to introduce Christo Carmen today. Christo's the CEO and co-founder of TransferWise, which many of you know is one of the pioneers in moving money across currencies, a story I haven't told you. So my research over many years has been about financial innovation, particularly taken by fintech. I thought most fintech firms were more hype than they were reality. But the one I would talk about, and this is before I met you actually, was TransferWise, because the economics of it and the kind of the operations of it just made so much sense that it used to be my talking point around fintech before we even met. And so I'm thrilled that Christo's here with us today to talk about his business and his journey as an entrepreneur. He also started in more traditional firms. He worked at, I suppose it's Deloitte and PwC, and then was frustrated by what he saw in financial service firms and decided that a new financial service firm could be created, and we all benefit from that. So with that, please join me in welcoming Christo Carmen. Thank you.
Clicker. Hello, everyone. The guys who are pitching after me, are you nervous? It's good. Don't worry. It's fine. It's going to be fine. I was here about 5 years ago, actually standing on the same stage, and I asked the same question that Peter asked. Like, how many of you have heard about TransferWise? And I thought like five hands coming up. So things have changed. And also the entrepreneurial course that I was talking at was, I think, like half the number of people than you have here today. So congratulations, definitely, for bringing everyone together, even in this weather. It's pretty amazing. So Peter kind of roped me into doing this, saying, hey, you know, there's these 300 people who want to ask you questions. I said, okay, cool, I'll come and I'll answer questions. And then he said, well, can you warm them up and tell them something beforehand? So that's what we agreed. I'm going to try and talk about 15 minutes, and then the floor is yours to ask questions. The story started pretty much the way that Peter described. If I had been in the audience at the time, I would have raised the hand that yes, I have needed to move money between countries, and I had used I only knew how to use a bank to do this. So I moved from Estonia to London in 2007 already, and I was 26 years old. And my salary in London, starting to work at Deloitte, was amazing. Like, I had so much money I had never had before, and I just couldn't use it. I was working as a shitty consultant job, and and then obviously this all extra cash that I had, I was sending back to my savings account, which was back in Estonia, so it was in euros. And my math was like, why do I keep it hanging here? I'll just put it in my savings account and earn, I think 2007, 2008, it was like 1% that you can earn on term deposits, 1%, 2%. So I did that. I went to HSBC, moved 10 grand in one lot. And when the money arrived in Estonia, about 500 euros was missing. And then I called up HSBC and said, hey, what happened? So, yeah, we did everything all right. And then I called up my Estonian bank and said, yeah, they did exactly what they were meant to do. And then I realized they had done exactly what they were meant to do. They just used an exchange rate that was completely arbitrary. I had no resemblance to the one that I was looking at when I looked at Reuters or Bloomberg or anywhere on the internet. So then I figured out what the trick was. That's how banks make money. So it wasn't the £15 that they charged me, and it wasn't just me having to go into the branch to sign some forms in 2007. But it was just they took €500 of my money. I was quite frustrated. I was quite angry, not just because I used something that was expensive. It was because I wasn't really told that this thing is going to cost me €500. And of course, I really felt stupid because I then realized I have to now wait 5 years in term deposit just to earn back what I lost in the milliseconds of the transfer. Well, not milliseconds. It took a week for the transfer to go through. So, being, you know, just eager to find a solution, I realized I have a friend who had the exact opposite problem. So he was working for Skype at the time but had moved to London, and his salary was still in euros in Estonia, and his expenses were in pounds. So next time I had to do this, it was easy. I just took my pounds that I had here. I gave it to my friend. I just made a transfer from my UK HSBC account to his UK Lloyds account. It didn't cost me anything. We looked at the Reuters exchange rate on the day, and he made the exact equivalent transfer in euros from his Estonian bank account to mine. It happened in a day, and either of us paid nothing to our banks. So that was, felt pretty proud for doing it. Not just because we saved a lot of money, like €500, although I had a lot by then, but €500 is still a lot of money. And the feeling that it kind of, we gained the system. That was awesome. So that was 2007. That was a long time ago. I was still working for Deloitte and trying to consult big banks on how they should modernize, and I realized this is not going to happen. So in 2010, we decided that this thing that works for us, it didn't quite compute how no one ever had come up with anything like this before. It just wasn't, it didn't compute. So 2011, January, we launched with a blog post on TechCrunch. TechCrunch at the time was pretty much the only tech blog. And the post said, there's two Estonian guys that built a website, so you can put in pounds and they will deliver euros to the account where you want it to, or you can put in euros and it delivers pounds. 15 minutes later, we have a transaction, like £2,000 appears on our account in the UK. That's pretty cool. Time goes by, we have euros collected on our Irish account, and more pounds, more euros. So actually, on the 24th of January 2011, at the end of the day, I had a book of business. Like, that was quite unexpected. I had no reason to expect that people will trust a website built by two Estonian guys. So it happened. Since then, just rolling time forward, we're now the official number, I think, is over 900, and we're just really a little bit short of 1,000. I'm waiting for the party. There's about almost 1,000 people in TransferWise now. We're in 9 offices all around the world. We move about $2 billion, our users move about $2 billion a month through the platform. We're in 62 countries, and it's gone pretty interestingly in the time. So I'm kind of warming you up for questions, so you're welcome to dig in into what you want to hear more of. I just thought I'd show you a couple of pics of how does startup life look like. So this is where it got started. It's a sauna. I'm from Estonia. We go to sauna a lot. So this is me, my co-founder, and our first engineer about 8 years ago, looking at our first website. It was terrible. So every business on the internet that gets started usually starts either in the corner of a conference room or a sauna or someone's bedroom. So there's nothing has changed there. Then once we had the products up, we had to let people know that they can use this website. And I still find this some of the most clever things we've done. It was in, now I think 4 years ago, we didn't really have a lot of money. We had already raised some funding. I think that was before Branson invested. And the genius of this is, actually, has anyone ever seen that picture before? Not here. Okay. So, there's one dude. The genius of that was we could only afford like 5 bus stops in London. But that was okay, because once we put the picture up on Facebook, it went absolutely viral. I think we had like 400,000 views or 500,000 views on that picture alone. So we started realizing that, okay, this expensive outdoor advertising, maybe there's a clever twist how we can actually use it. So this was also kind of the starting point of like how do we talk about what we do and why should people care? And we went back to the reason why we started it, why we needed a solution with me and my friend in the first place, and kind of really reliving our own emotions. By the way, one other clever thing on marketing, if you once you get that far, was in the early days I was still coding part of the site, and we're all very hands-on, and we had this invite program where you can, if you're using Trustwise, you can invite your friend to benefit from it. And that's very cool. But we had a text box there, so you could write in an email, and then there was a template email where you could change it. And one day, I can't remember what I was looking for, but I was looking for the logs through what people had written. And that was just amazing, because then I realized I don't need to do marketing anymore. I just need to let people use the product, do all the marketing. You can literally read through the words that they use when they describe your product. And you know, then we just print the words that they use, and this is one of the words. And then you move on from that. That was the kind of the next iteration. It's in front of the Royal Stock Exchange, in front of Bank of England, in the city. It was a demonstration initiated by us. So some of our users, some of our employees, some other people who are making a statement that we have nothing to hide. Unlike banks who have to hide their fees in the exchange rate, we have nothing to hide. It was fun. That was a bit later. That was also fun. That was what it was called, like bath to the banks, bathing the baths and hoping to clean them up. I think that was just at the back of the FX and LIBOR scandals. People really love the bubbles. So this one was it's a bit embarrassing. This is where we went slightly overboard. This is Barcelona, and the guy who did this stunt, and I really apologize to the public for us doing the stunt. He did get detained. the issue there, and I've kind of learned from it, is you want to make a big statement, but it's quite scary if, like, on the beach, people are looking in the yellow suits. That was unnecessarily frightening the public. But then people were starting to take notice. So this is where it gets exciting. That's now about a year ago. Journalists are starting to take their calculators out and kind of working out like what happens when you move money abroad. And then they realize that, oh, shit, banks are hiding their fees in the exchange rates where people People in this auditorium probably know how to look, but your boyfriends, your mother and father probably don't. There are ways that people don't want to engage with financial data, and they shouldn't be required to. So that was quite interesting. That came actually at the back of this little leak that was in one of Santander's, I don't know if it was a board deck or like an advisory committee. So they had basically figured out that if they were to copy TransferWise or be transparent to their users and kind of price the same way, they would lose, 85% of their profits. You know, I think that's fair. If you can do it cheaper, you should. And then we kind of continued the story. So that was another demonstration in the city, where we had this big tombstone and a coffin of hidden fees, which we gave a parade on the Halloween. And it's been really fun to do these with our users, because we can't tell them up front what's going to happen. So basically they're told there's a car outside 5:30 in the morning. Are you ready to go? And then they're really very scared when they arrive in there to get body painted and dressed up. So but they always go away with that was pretty cool. So you can do a lot with your own, and you should always try to engage your users, whatever product you're building, because they're going to be your biggest advocates. Because most of the day, this is what life looks like if you're working in a startup. So I'm suggesting you guys should get a job at a bank. It's much easier. That's it. That was the warm-up. I'm ready for questions. Okay, you had your hand up first. I also said questions and your hand was up. Sorry, yeah, right, hi. Pick me.
Thanks. Hi. So as a double-sided marketplace, which is always notoriously difficult to crack, at the beginning when you had someone, let's say, trying to transfer dollars into rubles, and rubles wasn't necessarily one of your primary currencies, how did you ensure that that transaction took place, and if it didn't, how did you incentivize them to come back to the platform?
It's a good question. That's exactly what I expect from an MBA and a financial student or a financial auditorium. Very good question. So there are two things that we did in the beginning. First of all, we went into just one route, pound and euro. So no dollars, no rubles, no nothing, just pound and euro. And you're right, even then it might be that just suddenly there are more people on our platform sending pounds to euros and not so many from euros to pounds. And then you have the kind of imbalance, and then you need to wait until you have more euros and these guys are waiting. So that's not a great thing to have. So the trick we used in the early days was dynamic limits. So what we did was we had exactly that problem. More people were sending pounds to Eurozone than we had people from the Eurozone sending money here. So we just set a limit and we needed to have limits in the early days as well, just to kind of be sure that we don't mess anything up. So we had a limit. I think you could send only 2,000 pounds to the Eurozone, but you could send 10,000 euros the other way around. So we had less payments on the euro side, but they were bigger, so that at the end they matched up. So that was the clever trick in the early days how to manage this. I mean, these days, they're moving like $2 billion a month. There is we have access to very large interbank markets, and when we lack the liquidity, then we go and buy it from the big banks. And given the volumes that we're doing, we can do it reasonably cheaply and kind of absorb the cost, because we always exchange money at the mid-market. So we're not as good yet. So no, we cannot really get money at the mid-market other than from our users. So there's a little bit of a cost involved in that, but that's fine. Good question.
Do you think that in general, very openly attacking incumbents as a marketing strategy is a good way to go? Because I think banks were quite universally distrusted around the time that you became active. But say you attack some other kind of incumbent, you're also risking a competitive response from them.
It's a good question. So attacking, and I think you have to be, we had to be, and we are very careful in what we're attacking. We're trying to avoid statements like banks are bad. Yes, culturally they're, and if you ever worked at a bank, you'll know that's a different organization than a tech company. But that's not, you know, that's not the problem that we're solving. We're solving very specifically the practice, the very widely spread practice that banks are hiding their fees. And although I might admire some of the other things that they're doing in terms of handling our money, this is something that I call out whenever I'm speaking with any of the CEOs or anyone who's willing to listen. I tell them this is not okay. This fact that you're hiding your fees, this is not okay. In no books, there's no way how this is okay. And I don't feel in any way bad in repeating that, because I still believe it's not okay. You should be really careful playing down the incumbents or just being angry at them. So if you look at the stuff that we've done, we're quite angry, but we try to play it out in a more kind of funny way, if we can. If you were asking specifically about governments, I think political parties do that all the time. They're frustrated with the other parties in power, so it kind of happens all the time.
Hi.
Hey.
Soumya Khawaja, I'm an executive MBA student candidate. I really admire your service. I use it myself.
Thank you.
But there are people, we are all privileged to have bank accounts here. If there are people in the world, about 2 billion of the world's population don't have bank accounts, have you considered tapping into that market? And also my other question is that regarding unjust fees, I absolutely agree. I'm doing a research on that as well. In the United States alone, there are people who are underserved who pay about $89 billion in fees only. And that's for like overdraft services and account activity services. So have you also considered providing a solution to that?
So good question. The question is, there are a lot of people who don't have bank accounts in the world. Not so much in the developed world or the kind of the Western world, but certainly so in other parts. And if you look into this problem, lots of people ask me that. And if you look into this problem, it's more of a behavioral, social challenge than a technical challenge. There are accounts in most countries. There are bank accounts or alternatives. Like in India, you have a lot of wallet systems. Like Paytm, I think, is bigger than any bank in India by the number of accounts. So it's not a technical problem. People can sign up to accounts. It's more that they don't want to, for some reason, or they can't get through the legal verification requirements. So this is kind of a big challenge, but sadly not a technical one. So I don't really have a solution for that yet. I know there are lots of other people who are solving it. For example, in India is a good example. In India, there's the pace at which digital wallets have taken over is amazing. China, the same with WeChat. That's and Alipay. This is a completely new world. I think this is happening, and the accounts will be available in Africa. You have like we send a lot of money to M-Pesa wallets, for example. You know, that's not a bank account, but do you really need a bank account if you can hold money electronically? That was your first question. The second question was, what was the second question?
Regarding the fees that the underserved
pay. Yes, people pay a lot of fees. And
you're talking about fees for transfers.
Yeah.
What about other account activity fees?
Yes, so it's a good question. Like, are there other problems that we can solve? Yes, there are. We're still in the very early days of solving the hidden fees in exchange rates. We have a solution to that. So my goal is to make these go away. I haven't succeeded yet, so I've got lots to do there. I think over time, it will have to be the case that banks will have to get more transparent in fees. I'm a little bit frustrated that I don't see regulators enforcing it and consumer protection agencies, but I think the internet is going to solve it for us.
Hi. You're doing about 2 billion per month, as you mentioned. What kind of percentage of what's your market share? What do you think your market share is? And second, I haven't really looked at your competitors. Once I started using TransferWise, I didn't go looking out. But I'm sure there are others. How do you see that popping up?
So the question is how many, like what's the, so 2 billion a month sounds like a big number. But of course, if you look at how much money moves, so every time you import something from somewhere, money has to follow, or money has to go the other way. So the whole market size is roughly, I think, around 40 trillion. 40 trillion is deliverable FX, or 40, 60 trillion. So that makes about 4 to 6 trillion a month, you could say.
Just a personal.
No, we have business. Businesses are using TransferWise as well. So to answer your question, I think our market share is roughly 0.1%.
So plenty of opportunity for others to come in, have they?
There's plenty of room for anyone who wants to play. There's 99.9 that are done by the banks, and I'm very excited that this is starting to go away very slowly, but in the UK and Europe, it's meaningful. There is a meaningful share going through non-banks already. The guy in the back.
I think big fan of TransferWise. A couple of questions. First is, you moved from having a good salary at Deloitte to an uncertain world of startups. So how was that experience personally for you? And secondly, when I started using TransferWise about 3-4 years back, the message was, come to us, Richard Branson has invested in us. And so how did that go, and how important that name was to build out TransferWise?
The first question, how did it feel like going from a Deloitte job to TransferWise? Oh, man, it felt good. but a serious question, like, are you worried to change the job? I have a very simple way to think about it. I can code. Like, as long as that is true, my job security is solved. I don't have to worry about like losing a job ever because I can code. That's it. To answer your question, Richard Branson is awesome. He's very well known. The fact that he's supported us, the fact that he was excited about what we're doing was awesome and definitely meant a lot to our users as well. So that's definitely definitely a good backer to have. Okay. Go in the back. Sorry, let's take the...
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation, and congrats again on your business. And I mean, like, the problem you're solving is real, and the solution you're providing is simple. So now you're growing from a disruptor to a kind of incumbent, at least in terms of like non-bank transfer. And how do you make sure you are on top of innovation? Because you are not replicated from somebody else.
Very good question. That's a very good question. So now that we're meaningful, we're profitable, well, break even. We don't take a lot of margin. We've been so for a year. A lot of people rely on us actually for moving their money. We also hold e-money or multi-currency accounts ourselves with balances. So that's, you know, you're right. It's quite serious now what we do. And how do we stay on top of innovation? It's actually simpler than you think. You really have to know what people care about. And we have worked out there's roughly three categories of things. One is speed. So they expect the money to move at the speed of light, which is exactly what I expect. When I send the email to someone, I expect the email to get there. And sending money isn't really that much more complicated than sending an email. So they want the money to move fast. They don't want to pay a lot for it. I don't want to pay a lot for it. And that kind of makes sense. And they want to do it really conveniently. They don't want to think and don't want to have friction in the process. So these are the three things that we innovate on. So now I think 70-80% of transfers coming to the UK are instant, so they get delivered in 20 seconds. Like no bank has been able to do that before. But we're still at like 70%, so there's a lot to go. We started with, when we priced the service, we decided that, you know, money is always going to change at the mid-market. So mid-market rate is basically where the buyer and the seller have the same rate. And we started with charging 0.5%. And we didn't know if it's right or wrong, but it kind of worked. It worked for the business. So now we've found that actually we've been able to scale and cut our costs. So we can now even reduce the prices. So we rolled out in the end of last year, price drops. So from UK to Eurozone, it's not 0.5, it's 0.35. So almost 25% price drop. And that's, for an MBA student, it's quite unusual. Like, why are these guys dropping their prices? Like, you can charge more. I mean, we charge about 8 times less than a bank does. Like, why do you drop the prices? Because we can. And because that's the right thing, and that's what users would want us to do, and that's the thing that gives us keeps us innovating. Yeah.
How did you go initially about building trust in your customers? Because in 2007, you were a relatively small startup dealing with people's personal savings. So how did you build this initial trust?
So the question is, how did we build trust? And as I said, I didn't expect to have earned that trust very quickly, because initially it was a website built by two Estonians. I was surprised that people trust this. I think there was already a wave of, you know, Skype had happened and people started to trust, like Google was there and was kind of showing that it's safe to do things online, to have email online, etc. So that kind of trust in online kind of started to happen. But certainly our early users were early adopters. With trust, I still believe that it's the power of word of mouth that makes trust happen. So you can put massive billboards of your brand out there, but that's not really gonna change your perception. No one's ever changed a bank from one to another because they saw an advert. That's never happened. But if you have a friend that tells you, I mean, you're a bit crazy if you still use your bank to move money abroad, then you may, okay, I'm not gonna trust this. I'm gonna nod but not do this. But if your next friend does the same, so if you hear it from two channels already, over time you're very likely to listen to them. And that's how trust comes about. So it comes about really slowly, and it's really painful. So you can't lose a single payment, and you have to delight every customer that you have. But eventually it's going to happen. And I haven't found a shortcut yet. All right, a few more questions. Yep. Guy with a mic.
If a universally accepted cryptocurrency were to emerge, what would be TransferWise's place in such a world?
Sorry, can you ask again?
So if a universally accepted cryptocurrency were to emerge, what would be TransferWise's place in such a world?
So if every merchant in the world accepted cryptocurrency, I think our job would be done. It's really hard to hide the fees in, if you look at what the exchanges are doing. In the crypto world, I think it's pretty, it's reasonably transparent. But of course, then there's a huge amount of work of converting all the dollar bills and pounds in the world to cryptocurrencies. That hasn't really started yet.
That you would be looking to, as a way to pivot TransferWise to?
No, because no one really accepts cryptocurrencies as a method of payment, especially the back of the latest volatility. That's a terrible idea to pay in cryptocurrency.
One mic.
Okay, we go. Guy there.
Hey, Christo. So I was just curious. So you guys, obviously, TransferWise has been a staple in sort of, you know, the fintech and alternative banking sort of revolution that we've seen. I'm curious if traditional banks, if you've received any pressure from a lot of, I guess, traditional institutions, whether they're offering to try to buy you out and shut it down or any sort of, I guess, you know, kind of under the table stuff that maybe they'd try to, you know, stuff that you had to deal with in the past.
It's a good question, and actually I have to give it to the banks that I haven't seen really a lot of foul play towards us. And I think partly the reason for that is banks, universal banks today are really large organizations where they have a lot of challenges. Like they have a lot of challenges. TransferWise is their challenge number 12. Like you have the interest rate situation, you have like mortgage scandals, like lots of products that are not working, you have people are revolting. And then of course in number 11, 12, you have international payments and TransferWise, but we're not really very high up their list. I think that's been kind of lucky. There hasn't been a lot of foul play towards us. Or where is it? Yeah. Oh, you had a question?
Yeah, if there's anyone else.
Okay, go for it.
I'm not trying to delay the pitch, I promise. My question was, at the beginning, once the tech was built out, what kind of a percentage of your budget was spent on marketing?
The tech is never built out, so we have 100... we have 200 engineers today. We do probably 150 commits and releases every day to the apps and the code base. It's amazing... amount of work still that needs to be done. So engineering is never done. But you asked when do we start marketing. And in some ways, you start marketing right away when you, like you as a founder, are telling people what you built and why they should be using it. We really didn't have a lot of money in the beginning for the first 2 years, so we didn't really spend marketing dollars. A lot of like these examples that I gave, these were really cheap to do, and even now we do spend on marketing. Facebook is our largest channel, but it's still actually very small. So most of our users come through word of mouth because of their friends and family tell them about TransferWise. All right. Yes.
Hi, did you do anything to prevent money laundering?
Sorry, what was the question?
Did you do anything to prevent money laundering?
Do we do everything?
No.
Yes, we do everything.
No. I mean, did you do anything to prevent? Yeah. Do you think?
So there are two things two reasons why what we do is a licensed activity. So when you handle other people's money, as we do, governments, for a couple of good reasons, want to be in some ways control in what you're doing. And there's two reasons. One is to avoid baddies getting away with money laundering, and the other is consumer protection. So that, I mean, if you're offering a financial service, you have to look after the consumers for all the reasons we talked about earlier. But certainly, we've had the chance to build up some really clever stuff from machine learning to a lot of kind of social stuff to be on top of the kind of know your customer and anti-money laundering practices. So this is a regulated activity anywhere in the world, and every government wants you to help them stop it. Gentleman there.
Thanks. The incumbents have been working with the regulators for a long time. What advice would you give to startups for engaging with the regulators? You're in a highly regulated area.
If you're operating in a highly regulated area, you should get involved right away. The rather question is, and I think the regulators in this country have now seen tech startups for at least as long as TransferWise has been around, and they know that this is actually quite important to have the regulators enabling like digital ways of doing things. Otherwise, Silicon Valley is just going to outrun everyone else. So this is it's actually in this country is quite important for regulators. Talking to regulators in South Korea, for example, is a different deal. They might not be as interested as guys here to talk to you. But if you're in a regulated area, that's you're going to spend quite a lot of your time trying to understand what do the regulators want to achieve? How does that translate to the more digital business, which I expect that you're working on? And how do you help them? How do you satisfy them? And how do you make it work better? It's not they're doing their job, and there's a good reason why we have regulators, because otherwise bad things would happen, and your job is to avoid it. Yep.
So obviously in Britain there's a lot of challenger banks that are coming out. I don't think it's working. Look at Revolut, million customers. You look at Monzo, 500,000. Obviously, there's probably a risk there that potentially they start to step into your space a little bit. Like, what do you see your strategy as? You see yourself as kind of providing the piping for these guys, and there be like white label or commoditization of what you're doing, or are you worried about controlling that customer experience and potentially building out your own equivalent in order to compete, be at the front of the minds of banking consumers today?
So first of all, I think that. Is this banking stuff boring for you guys, or do you want to hear more about it? Because I kind of live this stuff, so I spend too much time thinking about it. So banking, universal banking as we know it, I don't expect to work like this in like 5-10 years down the line. I do. So what the thing with banking is, it's incredibly national. So there's almost no global banks. There's UK banks, and there's French banks, German banks, South African banks, American banks. That's not the case with tech companies. So tech companies are, there's virtually no national tech companies apart from China and maybe some in India. Like most of the tech companies are inherently global. So I think that's where there's going to be a little clash that the very national banks are somehow seeing that the tech companies can have a global reach and do the products much better than they can locally. So I think, first of all, banking, universal banking is going to split up. So you'll have, if you need a mortgage is probably even actually the last one, but if you need a POS terminal, it's not going to be your bank who's going to give you the POS terminal. It's going to be Stripe or iZettle. If you need to move money across borders, it's going to be TransferWise. If you need a loan, it's going to be someone like Funding Circle. So I think this is going to get much more global and much more unbundled or much less bundled than banking is today. Therefore, I do think that... there's a lot of opportunities for all the guys you mentioned to build services that solve parts of banking. I think it's very, very hard to solve the entire banking by a startup. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but certainly there's going to be parts of banking sold by different startups. Doing that globally is so much better and so much more efficient than the banks can do it today.
Hi. So building up on two previous questions regarding the imperative of keeping on the top of with the technical developments and the innovation, and also the fast adoption of cryptocurrencies. If we move fast forward 10 years from now on, where do you see your business model, and what can you do to prevent TransferWise from becoming extinct?
I mean, if TransferWise, if the problem goes away, I would definitely expect TransferWise to go extinct. I have no problem with that. If there's a way how to move currencies cross-border, either through banks without any hidden fees and at the cost and speed that I would expect, being instant and virtually free, if that becomes possible, you know, I think we've done our job. I'd be really, really happy about this. And if a company exists in this world or not, it doesn't really matter. I don't really have a path other than doing what we're doing to get there.
I think that's all we've got time for, I'm afraid.
Oh, awesome.
I think that was the last question. So thank you so much.